Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Bridge to the Pacific Northwest. The HO Scale Canada, Spokane, and Pacific joins Burlington Northern and Canadian Pacific in 1981. By Lou Sassy, photos by the author. Drew James was introduced to model railroading at the age of 10 when his parents gave him an AHM train set. During his younger years, he never put that railroad away. His parents weren't interested in trains, but they supported his hobby by driving him to model train shops, taking him on Amtrak trips, and giving him space in the basement in which to build his first model railroads. Some years later, after Drew married his wife Carol, he built two more layouts in their first home. Both were medium-sized, direct-current-controlled railroads, and neither reached completion. Then Drew read the V&O Story series of articles in Railroad Model Craftsman and adopted the concept of a linear single-track walk-around railroad. In the mid-1980s, he took several trips on Amtrak's Empire Builder and VIA Rail's Canadian. These trips cemented his love for the Burlington Northern, BN, and Canadian Pacific Railway, or CPR. Modeling the BN in this period allowed Drew to include equipment from its predecessor railroads, especially his personal favorite, the Great Northern. In Drew and Carol's second home, he built his first incarnation of the Canada, Spokane, and Pacific, or CS&P. This was also a modest size, but similar in concept and design to the present layout. It incorporated digital command control and was fully signaled, evolving into a railroad that could support 4 to 6 operators. In the second version of the railroad, Drew modeled the Pacific Northwest between Calgary, Alberta, and Spokane, Washington, in June 1981. His CS&P is jointly owned by the BN and CPR and is a bridge line connecting the two railroads in order to expedite north-south traffic. The railroad also serves several towns and industries between Spokane and Calgary. Lumber, grain, pulp, paper, and coal are the largest revenue generators, but there are also a significant number of industrial products shipped over the railroad. Canadian National has traffic rights between CN Junction, located just south of Boundary, and Castlegar. The CS&P continues to run passenger service over the line. Drew learned a lot over the years that he incorporated into the layout you see here. With help from his good friend Dave Martini, he designed the railroad for operation, the top priority being a long, single-track main line connecting several towns, providing plenty of switching opportunities. The pair came up with two basic designs and chose the two-peninsula option as it provided an additional 40 feet of main line. The primary compromise was that operators had to walk around the Castlegar Peninsula in order to follow trains arriving or departing Nelson, but this hasn't been an issue during operations. It also introduced long runs between towns, giving operators a sense of traveling greater distances. While the town names are real, Drew has made no effort to model them prototypically. A 4-foot-wide aisle between Nelson and Castlegar provides operators plenty of room in this busy area. The previous version of the CS&P had a double-ended open staging yard. This concept worked so well that it was carried over to this railroad. Drew likes how it allows for continuous running during open houses, eliminates the need to back trains around the layout when restaging, and allows easy access when building trains between sessions. The layout was designed using CAD rail software. The main line has a minimum radius of 36 inches and a maximum grade of 2% (parentheses) between Spokane staging and Kettle Falls (close parentheses). Number 6 turnouts are standard on the main, with a few number 4 in the industrial areas. Building benchwork. Work on the present railroad began in 2015. The basement room in which the layout resides was prepared by the home builder with the addition of drywall and a drop ceiling. Drew installed 66 light-emitting diode spotlights to enhance the room's fluorescent lighting. A dedicated power sub-panel and extra outlets were added. Drew also installed remote wireless power outlets so the layout can be easily powered on and off using a single controller. The benchwork was constructed with 3-inch pine L-girders. Roadbed in the flat and yard areas consists of a laminate of homasote and half-inch plywood. Spline topped with homabed was used for the longer mainline runs between towns. All track and turnouts are Atlas Code 83. The photo backdrops were provided by Bill Brown's LARC products. Some of the photos Bill used were taken by Carol outside Glacier National Park. The backdrops in the towns are collages of photos from LARC's CD collection that were printed, cut, and pasted onto foam board or directly onto the walls. Behind many of the photo backdrops, distant mountains were painted onto the walls. Mountain scenery. In addition to providing the backdrops, Bill shared with Drew his scenery construction knowledge and techniques. Drew chose the colors of his scenery materials to match the backdrops. Basic landforms for the larger mountains were constructed using cardboard strip lattice covered with layers of hydrocal hardshell. This was coated with a layer of structolite. Smaller scenery areas were made with stacked and carved foam board. A variety of hydrocal molds were used for rocks, cliffs, and outcroppings. Rock formations were colored using diluted earth tone latex paints and India ink / alcohol washes to accent the crevices. Flatter open areas were painted with earth-colored latex paints. Drew used dried and sifted real dirt along with a variety of colors and textures of ground foam from multiple manufacturers as ground cover throughout the layout. Once applied, the ground foam and dirt were misted with isopropyl alcohol to break the surface tension and sprayed with either diluted white glue or matte medium. Static grass was applied in several scenes, particularly in flat, wet areas. There are more than 1,600 trees on the layout, with more being added regularly. The vast majority are spruce, which were scratch-built using the bottle brush method. The hardwood trees are Scenic Express super trees. Additionally, there are more than 100 large trees made from hydrangea blooms from Drew's backyard. All the trees were spray-painted, then coated with adhesive and sprinkled with an appropriate colors of Woodland Scenic's ground foam and Scenic Express leaf material. Water was modeled using both Envirotex, two-part epoxy, and Woodland Scenic realistic water. Drew prefers the Woodland Scenic's product, as it has no odor. Woodland Scenic's water effects was used to create ripples and rapids. The snow on the mountains above the snowshed between Northport and Kettle Falls is Woodland Scenic's soft flake snow. Drew used an assortment of techniques to build structures. Several, including Martini Manufacturing, BC Power, and Washington Milling, were scratch-built using styrene laminated over foam board. The Castle Gar, Kettle Falls, Boundary, and Northport stations were built from laser-cut wood kits. Most others are modified styrene kits. Typically, they were combined or added to in some manner to create a structure big enough to justify railroad service. Drew used Walther's modular walls to build Bucky's Brewery and to expand other kits. Most of the structures have some sort of interior detailing, either 3D details and figures or interior photos depending on how easily the interior can be seen by operators or visitors. Future plans include additional interior lighting for many of the structures, as well as on the streets and in parking lots. Drew's favorite scene on the layout is the crossing of the Upper Columbia River on the High Bridge just north of CN Junction. The bridge was scratch-built by John Roche, as were the bridge and trestle in Nelson. There are soundboards under the layout for continuous sound effects, such as running water. Intermittent sounds, including the sawmill and singing hobos, are controlled by Java Model Railroad Interface, or JMRI software, to play at random intervals. Locomotives and freight cars. Drew strives toward realism with his rolling stock while reflecting the layout's time and location. More than 60% of the road's 350 cars are owned either by the BN or CP due to those railroads' joint ownership of the line. Because of its interchange in Castle Gar and trackage rights from there to Boundary, there are also many CN cars. Drew maintains an inventory of all the rolling stock to help guide his future purchases. Freight cars are a mix of boxcar, center beam, and bulkhead flat cars and covered hoppers. One of Drew's favorite trains is Rapido's The Canadian Steamliner, parentheses called the Northwest Limited on the CSNP, close parentheses, which Carol gave him for their 25th wedding anniversary. There are 35 locomotives on the railroad, most of which are first and second generation electromotive division diesel electrics owned by either the BN or CP. There's a mix of 4 and 6 axle units. All locomotives are equipped with digital command control and sound. All equipment is weathered prior to being put into service. Drew starts by applying a coat of enamel matte finish, followed by applications of pan pastel products, weathering powders, and colored pencils and thinned paints. Drew's friend Connor Hawes of CDH Weathered has recently started weathering the railroad's motive power using a mix of oil and enamel paints. Layout and train control. Control of the layout, not including trains, is implemented with a 14-node Layout Command Control, or LCC, network tied into JMRI. The LCC standard was released by the National Model Railroad Association shortly before construction on the railroad, and Drew recognized that it would be a good fit for his CSNP. The LCC network runs the signal system, turn-up control, and accessories such as sound modules. RR Circuits is the supplier of the LCC hardware. The dispatcher's office features a fully operational replica of a Union Switch and Signal Centralized Traffic Control, or CTC, machine built by Drew, Dave Martini, and Ken Cameron, parentheses C, dispatching with a CTC machine, at left, close parentheses. The fully operational signal system can be used in either absolute block signal, ABS, or CTC mode. The signals are G-type, made by Atlas and Tomar Industries. Mainline turnouts are controlled with Tortoise by Circuitron switch motors operated by push buttons on the fascia or from the CTC machine. Light-emitting diode indicators for turnouts are on the fascia. All other turnouts have Caboose Industries ground throws. A few mainline turnouts needed by the local crews to perform switching may be locked by the dispatcher to respond to either local control using the fascia buttons or from the CTC machine. Trains are controlled by an NCE Pro Cab DCC system. There are 3 5A boosters in addition to the command station. There are 12 power districts, each protected by a breaker in order to minimize the impact of a short in any given area, as well as assist in troubleshooting. Drew installed detected subbuses to protect the main line and sidings, which would be signaled and under dispatcher control. The subbuses allow for multiple track drops to all feed through a single NCE BD20 detector. Freight and passenger operations. The railroad hosts a wide variety of traffic, including manifest and through freights, local switching, and passenger service. Switch lists are used for car routing. Drew has developed a spreadsheet listing every car on the railroad and specifying its location, destination, and train. There's a 6-day rotation, with day 6 rolling back to day 1. The switch lists are built from a master spreadsheet. About 200 cars are moved in each session. Cars also rotate in and out of storage over the course of that 6-day sequence. Drew uses a GML Enterprise 5-to-1 fast clock. There are 6 clocks distributed between the train room, dispatcher's office, and crew lounge. Trains are scheduled to depart at specific times to space them out during a session. Whiteboards in the train room and crew lounge show train departing times and crew assignments. However, once out on the railroad, only passenger trains operate on a timetable. A typical operating session lasts 2.5 to 3 hours and can support up to 16 operators, including a dispatcher, Kettle Falls switch crew, Nelson yardmaster, and assistant yardmaster, along with 6 road crews consisting of an engineer and a conductor. Crews use radios to communicate with a dispatcher. Andy Slough modified a Radio Shack intercom system by adding a foot pedal and boom microphone for the dispatcher. the future of the layout. Although Drew's CS&P is essentially complete, he has what he refers to as an unending list of, quote, fun tasks, waiting for him to tackle. There are many upgrades he wants to make on the structures, rolling stock, and scenery. He's removing anything on the layout that's not correct for the time period. Drew plans to equip many of his structures with interior lighting kits. He's also considering backdating the layout's modeled period by a few years, possibly to 1978, and replacing his CP-equipped Northwest Limited with Amtrak rolling stock. In addition, he's developing options for operating sessions that will use timetable and train order, or TTTO, or track warrants rather than CTC dispatching, in order to add more challenge. Drew feels that model railroading is a hobby best enjoyed with others. By enlisting the assistance of his friends, Drew has been able to build a large layout in a much shorter period of time than it would have taken if he were working alone. Meet Drew James. A retired business executive, Drew lives with his wife Carol near Syracuse, New York. They have two adult sons, Bradley and Nathan. Besides model railroading, Drew enjoys traveling, sports, and reading about military history. Drew is active in the National Model Railroad Association and is currently the superintendent of the Central New York Division. The next article is titled Turning Engines on a Stub-End Staging Yard. A flip-up turntable sector plate makes a finicky task easier. By David Hull. Photos by John Bershnell. Several decades ago, with the advent of using staging tracks for model railroads, our miniature world suddenly became larger. With this concept, model railroading changed from moving trains around abbreviated circles to more of a point-to-point transportation network. Many model railroader articles through the years have compared the different styles of staging tracks. Open-ended, parentheses, or double-ended, close parentheses, staging yards allowed trains to enter on one end and exit on the other. I used this concept on my prior layout, the Penn Valley Railroad, see the October 2008 issue of Model Railroader. That hidden staging yard was located behind a wall with remote cameras to view both ends. Physical access, when needed, required getting on my hands and knees to go through an opening in the wall under the layout. Fortunately, because it was a run-through staging yard, it didn't require individual engines and lash-ups to be turned between operating sessions. A new model railroad. On my current layout, I use a dedicated aisle within the layout room to easily access a 12-foot-long, stub-ended, visible staging yard. On the other side of this yard is a long city scene. Both the city and the staging yard share a peninsula with a hardboard backdrop separating each. A problem with such stub-end yards is how to efficiently turn and or run engines around to place them on the other end of trains to get them ready for the next operating session. One way to do this is to manually pick up the engines after each operating session, turn them, and place them on the other end of the yard. Steam engines are particularly difficult to handle this way. It's hard to keep the drawbar and connector wires attached between the engine and tender while at the same time striving to rerail the leading, trailing, and tender trucks. Moving multiple unit diesel consists prevents similar issues. Rerailing a steam engine and tender or a multi-unit consist of diesels in the midst of a 10-track staging yard full of rolling stock isn't very fun. Searching for solutions. A turnout ladder with runaround and escape tracks could be used to reposition the locomotives. However, this would take far too much space and the locomotives would still have to be turned. A pivoting sector plate could use less space, but again wouldn't allow for turning. One of my friends, the late Dave Wintermute, came up with a better idea. His solution was to design and install a large flip-up turntable at the stub end of the yard with all 10 tracks flowing into it. Since this device is only used between operating sessions, it's not scenic, is turned manually, and never blocks the aisle during operating sessions. The single device compactly serves the escape and runaround functions of a sector plate and the consist turning function of an extra-long turntable. Furthermore, its long length makes it suitable for turning both locomotives and passenger cars. Time to build. To construct this ingenious device, they first built a 21-inch by 72-inch vertical wall at the stub end of the yard. This wall conceals the end of the open staging and also provides support for the device. He then mounted a 17-inch by 26-inch piece of medium-density fiberboard, or MDF, to that wall using a 16-inch long stainless steel piano hinge. Dave used another layer of MDF to build the 22-inch long turntable pit and bridge. A pair of hinged legs functioning as knee braces complete the flip-up assembly. A 4.5-inch by 18-inch hole was cut through the wall, then short track extensions were laid to connect the staging tracks to the turntable. A 5.5-inch by 21-inch piece of removable hardboard covers the hole during operating sessions. Reliable wiring. My friend Greg Heater created a straightforward electrical setup. The turntable pivots on a 2-conductor phone plug and mating socket. The positive and negative track power wires are routed through a manually operated double-pull double-throw, or DPDT, polarity-reversing toggle switch with the 2 output wires connected to the conductors on the pivot socket. Each wire from the plug is soldered to one of the turntable rails. We painted the ends of the staging tracks white, one end of the turntable bridge white, and the corresponding side of the toggle switch white. When the white end of the turntable lines up with the white staging tracks, the toggle needs to be thrown to that white side. You could also replace the toggle switch with a frog juicer or similar commercial electronic device to change the turntable polarity automatically. We opted instead for the low-cost toggle switch solution, ready when you need it. The turntable slash sector plate hangs down 99% of the time until I need to turn and run around or reposition locomotives. For those occasions, I simply lift the slotted hardboard off the screw post anchors on the wall and swing the platform up to a level plane. I then rotate the turntable bridge manually to align it with the track of the engines to be turned, run the engines onto the bridge, manually spin the turntable to the always unoccupied, quote, through track in the center of the yard, flip the DPDT's toggle switch if the table was reversed, and run the engines to the proper yard track. When finished, I drop the table and reposition the cover plate, ready to host the next operating session. David Hull is a retired government employee of the United States Air Force. His previous 2 layouts were featured in Great Model Railroads 1989 and the October 2008 issue of Model Railroader, respectively. David resides in the Dayton, Ohio area. The next article is On Operation by Jerry Dzik. 493's Extra. Robert Frost, my favorite poet, painted New England in words so vivid that I can almost smell the smoky sweet aroma of maple syrup drizzled over pancakes and bacon. New England beckons rail fans, too. Boston and Maine's classic moguls, Maine Central's Frankenstein trestle, and Canadian National's unmistakable imprint in central Vermont and Grand Trunk. Roger Cook's article about Island Pond, Vermont, and last fall's issue of Classic Trains had me revisit my collection. I labeled the slide seen at right with, quote, power for number 493, end quote, a daily Portland, Maine to Montreal through freight. But why is GP38-25551 resplendent in snapping white flags and class lights so typical of the region? A train with a schedule number is a regular train, not an extra. Roger gave the answer. While all Grand Trunk trains operated as extras, quote, all the GT men I met used their former timetable numbers, end quote. Here's another prototype practice we can polish our operations with. Harold Kruer and I corresponded about this. In part, it comes from a subtle distinction between traffic and trains. Harold described Rock Island's Auto Parts hotshot ARRO. It ran extra on double track and didn't get a schedule number until it reached single track timetable and train order territory at West Liberty, Iowa. However, quote, from the moment it left Blue Island, Chicago, it was always referred to as 57, end quote. Rock dispatchers rolled this traffic under 2 identities. Extra 295 West, for example, and number 57. Harold remarked that Toledo, Peoria, and Western dispatchers often annulled freight schedules to move traffic early. Quote, number 20 was carted between East Peoria and Logansport, Indiana, but if number 122 from Fort Madison, Iowa had a good run and the through cars for Conrail were ready, then 20's extra was born, end quote. annulling the schedule and running the extra expedited the traffic. This also allowed other trains to move more freely, not tied down by 20's schedule. Harold tossed in two trains articles detailing Rock Island and Katy operations, Ed Bruner's in July 1980, and Fred Fraley's in September 1986. Fred reported the dizzying example of CBL-8, operating as number 109 from Ney, Fort Worth, to Belmead, Waco, and number 103, thence to Smithville. Consider a schedule as track space. Its times reserve the space for a train. These two schedules were available when CBL-8's traffic was ready to move. Railroaders color railroading. 493's extra evokes a time when 493 and its eastbound counterpart 490 ran behind handsome S-Class 2-8-2s. The bootlegger persisted long after Prohibition when Central Vermont railroaders bestowed it on the Washingtonian. Newsprint traffic made Delaware and Hudson's RW6 the quote paper train. There are more nicknames in a 1952 pamphlet published by the Association of American Railroads. Southern's, quote, spark plug between Cincinnati and Atlanta and, quote, jackpot between Jacksonville, Florida and Potomac Yard outside Washington, D.C., describe their traffic well. Illinois Central's CC6, better known as the meat train than as number 76, also drew, quote, hot shot and, quote, pork chop. JG1/GJ2, Jersey Central's service between Jersey City and Phillipsburg, New Jersey, earned, quote, maybe. A CNJ employee I asked in the early 70s explained, quote, maybe it'll get there and maybe it won't, end quote. But IC's, quote, naked lady from Centralia to Chicago stumps me. It handled BC4 traffic, and let's leave it at that. As pleasing to the ear as these were, each operated as a regular train or an extra, addressed that way on train orders and clearance forms, and so entered on a dispatcher's train sheet. Today, however, symbols make a train's formal identity. A dispatcher might refer to a Z train as, quote, BNSF 8330 on the radio or in a track warrant, but it's Z-KCM-DEN-23 in official railroad records. I tried to recreate wonderful Phil Hastings' photo by catching 493's extra on the Casco Bay Bridge during my Portland visit. I savored the prospect over a steaming, buttery lobster dinner on Commercial Street afterward. The film proved mine a meager attempt. Well, the meal shirt didn't disappoint, though I wonder why Robert Frost never got around to lobster. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@AfterSight.org. Thank you for listening. Thank you.